Years in the making, this meeting. Near as we can tell, the governor has never come to an official gathering of the Public Service Commission, so we're honored that you would take us up on the invitation and really looking forward to the discussion this morning, Governor. Before we get started, and we'll just do like introductions, and then I'll say a couple opening comments and invite my colleagues to do the same, and then we're going to kick it over to you to hear from you on the net zero goals. And I know we could all probably talk most of the day about energy because we're all really excited about energy in North Dakota, but we have, I think, about an hour for the conversation. And then I think all of us are heading down to the Lignite Energy Council for that meeting, so we'll get to continue talking about energy down there for the rest of the afternoon. So with that, we'll just invite my colleagues will make comments in a minute, but we wanted to introduce our staff at the table, and you can do the same. And then we'll just highlight some of our other staff in the room, and then we'll come back to us. So go ahead, Pat.
I'm Patrick Fawn. I'm the Director of the Public Utilities Division for Public Commission.
Morning, Patrick.
Morning.
Go ahead,
Steve. I'm Steve Baldwin. I'm the Executive Director of the agency. I'm Josh, your legal staff.
Steve, John, good to see you guys.
And then we've got
I've got, go ahead, Reese Haas, Policy Advisor.
Yep.
Excellent. Thank you, Reese. For you guys, because we are broadcasting, you should make sure to have the mic on when you're talking. And then over here, we have our PUD group. They're our PUD mafia. They kind of look like it right now in all their suit coats. But we have Adam Renfant on the end, Marcus Detloff, Victor Shook, and Brian Johnson. And so their PUD is Public Utilities Division, and so they deal a lot with the regulation of the utilities, basically. And all the siting and all that is run by our Public Utilities Division. The rest of our staff is hard at work. We also do have Stacy Eberl back here. She's going to take a picture of us to mark this historic event. She's our public affairs person. And then Matt over there is our IT director. He keeps us running and connected, and he was the one that was able to get us, when you gave us the authority to do so, the hearings remotely, he made that happen without a missing beat during COVID. So we were really proud of Matt and all the hard work that he and his folks in the IT division did. So he keeps us in the modern age. All right, so should we quick take a picture? Because I do think it's important to, did you get all of us, Stacy? Well, maybe we'll have the governor come up and get all three of us with the governor. Just quick.
Somebody's got the back of their head.
Yeah, exactly.
You get multiple ones here.
Yeah, right here. All right,
great. Good, awesome. And Dave for his website. Okay, very good. All right. Well, with all those formalities completed, we are, again, really excited to have you here to talk about energy, and this is a historic event. It seems like this shouldn't be such a big deal for all of us to talk about these things, and we do individually, but to get us all together and talking in a group is a formal public meeting, and so that's a little bit more unusual, but it feels appropriate to do something historic because we are kind of in historic times when it comes to energy, and North Dakota has been incredibly blessed, and as we all know, to those which much has been given, much is expected. And so I think we have, because of our riches in our state in the energy sector, it's incumbent on us to provide leadership, not just in our state, but in our region and nationally. And as I think about how all of us are working and the other members of the Industrial Commission and our legislature, I think North Dakota is doing that. I mean, we really are, with your work on IOGCC, NGA, RGA, here at the commission. Randy's really involved in SPP and set up to be the SPP state committee leader next year. Brian is providing leadership on the Clean Coal Committee through NARUC. I'm working on MISO and OMS and NARUC leadership as well. We've got Wayne and Doug doing things in their areas. We've got the legislature. And so North Dakota has really deliberately positioned itself as a leader, tax, regulatory policy, in every way in energy. And so it's awesome to see how we are positioned. And And then on top of all of that work, decades of work, you came in a few months ago and threw out this aspirational goal of net zero by 2030. And I think all of us were like, really? Wow. Okay. How's that going to work? And, you know, we're all like pragmatic policy people thinking like, what's the implications here, there, and everywhere. And as we've heard you all talk, I think we're getting a better understanding of your goal. But today is really a good chance to hear more about that and hear how we might be part of it and help kind of work to be rowing in the same direction and helping to provide North Dakota's take on these goals that are occurring throughout the nation in different ways. And I think it really provides an opportunity for us to contrast our approach to the rest of the country and really provide a pathway for the development, ongoing development of our resources, not only for North Dakotans, but for the world. So exciting. With that, I wanna just kick it over to Brian and then Randy, and then we'll invite you. So, thank you. Go ahead, Randy.
I'm Randy. That's Brian.
Oh, sorry. Did I say Brian and Randy? Sorry. At least I didn't say Brandy, which I have done.
I won't repeat a lot of that stuff because I agree with just about everything Julie said. I was going to say at the beginning.
You got to turn your mic on.
I was going to say at the beginning that this is the first time that the governor's been here in the last 8.5+ years. I did not do the research back 130 years, and so even more historic than I originally thought. I want to point out I have an appointment for an award distribution down at the Lignite Energy Council, so I may have to leave a little bit early. It seems incredibly rude to leave early from a historic event, so I hope you'll understand that. And lastly, as this evolves, like Julie said, kind of started with the carbon neutrality aspiration. One of the things where I have the most questions is on the whole hydrogen concept that's been discussed this summer with Bakken Energy and Mitsubishi. So if you don't mind getting into some of that discussion as well, I really have some questions in that regard. So I'm looking forward to the morning.
All right, well, welcome Governor Reese, welcome as well, and everyone else that attended. I'm anxious to hear what you have to say, so I'm gonna keep this really, really short. I would encourage you to view the PSC as a resource as you're looking at your plans for carbon reduction and carbon neutrality by 2030. North Dakota is uniquely positioned to do that. But as a regulatory body, our role is to make sure that companies operating in North Dakota operate within the parameters of the law, that they do so within those parameters. So view us as a resource in terms of questions you may have for different projects, different initiatives, as it all comes together. It's multifaceted, obviously, in so many ways. And I think we would be valuable in that respect because we do want companies to remain in compliance and operate within the parameters of the law. But we want to do that because it helps stimulate future economic development in the state. When people are doing it right and entities are doing things correctly, it leads to more good things. And I think North Dakota is at a very exciting point in its energy industry. I think this is the next chapter in that story, that energy story. So with that, greatly look forward to hearing your comments and vision.
Great, thank you all. And then do I understand we have some slides too? We have a...
Yep, Matt is just pulling them up here.
While he does that, Julie mentioned Matt and our IT people getting us going for hearings remotely when that happened. Also our legal staff and worked on that, but we were, I believe, the first regulatory agency in the nation that was able to achieve our hearings remotely that has, you know, these kind of regulations that some of them be held in certain counties and things like that. So it was really wonderful that our staff was able to make that happen because there were some projects that got construction started last summer because we were able to move so quickly and be nimble.
Well, that fits in right where I'd like to start, which is with gratitude and to the chair and commissioners that are part of this historic invitation today, I just want to say thank you for inviting me. It's very fun to be here. I'm smiling because I'm happy to be here. I'm also smiling because if I took a picture from where I'm sitting, it looks like there's a UND gnome sitting on Julie's shoulder, like right perfectly over her shoulder.
Perfectly
and so
placed.
Thankfully it's flanked by an NDSU cup and an NDSU helmet on the week when we're also historically going
That's
back
right.
to UND to play up at UND with the big annual football game. So, but great, excited to be here. I also want to share gratitude, really not just on behalf of Lieutenant Governor Brent Sanford and myself and not just our staff, but really the citizens of the state, because the role that all of you play is so, so important. And I know that regulators often, you know, get beat up sometimes because you've got to make hard decisions for what you do. But I really think that the PSC in North Dakota is a shining example of a citizen-focused agency. The way that you folks listen, the length of the hearings you have, the outreach you've done in person, the speed at which you achieve the outreach, to reach out virtually to people and keep industry moving in North Dakota is really something, and I think few people really appreciate. I think everybody kind of knows your involvement, you know, with the grid and with the work that you do there on energy-related utilities and in-state pipeline regulations, but I'm sure people aren't know that you're also dealing with mine reclamation and you're dealing with auctions and railroads and telecoms and weights and measures. And I know that, like all state agencies, you've got a small and mighty staff that works extremely hard. And so to your staff, I want to say thank you, and to you all three for your leadership for this job, because this is another one of these public, you're the public service commission, but all of you are in service to the public and doing a great job. So just grateful, because your work does touch every citizen in the state. And I think the other thing which Julie mentioned in her opening comments about our state, I do believe that North Dakota is incredibly well positioned, in part because we've got a regulatory framework that supports the attraction of capital and talent to our state to innovate. And I know that you've understand that, and I think that you're always looking for ways to work with industry to help move us forward as opposed to holding them back, and whether it's been streamlining permitting process, eliminating outdated rules, your work on digitizing the hearings, you've always been an inspiration to the rest of Team ND, and as Randy is pointing out, to the rest of the country, because you're really, really leading other regulators in the work that we do every day in state government to empower people, improve lives, and inspire success. And I think that we think about those six words every day, and we know that you're doing that as well. I know also that there are folks that are a key part of this conversation that are probably listening in, the independent service operators, MISO and SPP, also became more in the news last year when we had the polar vortex and the challenges across the country. And I think it's a something that our modern electrical grid is something that people can take for granted. It's truly a miracle. And we in the U.S., I think, are so used to whatever it is that we're doing, you know, flipping a switch on the wall or, you know, turning on a device or plugging in something to charge, that we just take for granted that it's always going to be there. But we know that part of that miracle is that it's one of the only commodities in some ways. We think of it as a commodity, that it's consumed and produced at exactly the same time, but it places very distant from each other. And so that's a current way of life, and with everything from manufacturing to healthcare to education couldn't operate without the incredible work that all of you are doing. So we look forward to the collaboration. I think the place that we all recognize where we are today is that we're in a spot where we've got some real challenges, and those challenges include economic challenges. They include sometimes accumulation of decades of federal subsidies that might, you know, favor one form of energy over another. And we've also got a current administration and certain portion of people that are really trying to eliminate all carbon-based sources of energy. And they're trying to do that by regulating them or taxing them or doing things to put them out of business. And when I look at this, you look at the federal administration and what they've done in the last 6 months, in some ways it's almost been an all-out war against certain segments of the industry. And I think that There's, you know, dangerous and disturbing precedents. I mean, just as a, forget being governor, just as a someone who, you know, grew up in North Dakota and lived here virtually my entire life, to see our president a few weeks ago asking OPEC to increase production when we've got, you know, out of work energy workers in the state of North Dakota is distressing and disturbing. I think it reflects a lack of basic understanding that, that our nation produces energy cleaner and more efficiently than any other nation in the world. And anytime we ask somebody else to produce energy that would be then, you know, shipped on a, you know, Atlantic tanker to come to the U.S., that is, you know, not only less efficient, but it's less clean. It's less clean production because we produce it cleaner and more efficiently here. And so it's something that's not only bad for our economy, but bad for the environment. So if you really care about the environment, you'd want to have all the energy that our country consumes produced here. And you'd want to have the U.S. be the leading exporter of energy because we do it better and cleaner than anyone. That would be the way to really help the environment. So we did achieve that under the previous administration for the first time since World War II. The U.S. was in a position for first time since World War II where we were actually in a position to sell energy to our friends and allies versus buy it from our enemies. And it appears in the last 6 months that we're reversing that with the idea that we're going to go back to that. And when we think about our soldiers that have fought and died in the Middle East trying to protect really, you know, energy markets, it's not just sad, it's tragic. And so I wanted to say again with the this baffling situation that we're in right now, we also have another headwind. I mean, I'll call that sort of the political environment and the and some of the unbalanced tax advantages that favor one versus another or trying to eliminate entire categories of carbon base. But the other thing which we have to realize is there's now $45 trillion of capital tied up around the world in ESG investing. And ESG investing also has a strong bias against investing in anything that's related to, you know, a carbon-based energy industry. And, of course, right now our nation is dependent on carbon-based energy for baseload. And if we don't have baseload, affordable, sustainable, reliable, resilient baseload, if we don't have that, then we're not going to achieve what we were achieving in the last previous administration was seeing manufacturing jobs coming back to the United States. And again, if we really care about the global environment, a person can have different opinions and different views about, you know, climate change, its rate, its direction. You can have all those discussions, but I think for us as a state right now, we have to look at the $45 trillion. That's what we were looking at when we made the announcement, which is if we can't attract capital to innovate, it doesn't matter. And I understand that in the some of the worst case scenarios of, you know, if you were to believe, you know, dozens of models that say by 2100, we're going to have between a 1 and 2 centigrade increase in global temperature, if you were to believe that, that would mean that North Dakota in the year 2100 would have the climate of South Dakota because they're about 2 degrees warmer than we are. So I'm just saying that's what the data would show. Probably good for pheasant hunters, some milder winters, but we have to operate within the $45 trillion of capital that is constraining and not going towards these solutions. And I say that because China, in a report in August, has certified that they have authorized 43 additional new coal plants. Those coal plants that are going up are huge. And so the idea that somehow we're going to achieve net gains on solving global climate problems with shutting down a few plants in the U.S., which would create instability to our grid, while China builds 43, and under the international accords, they've got the rest of this decade to keep building up their level of carbon emissions before they have to start coming down. So we'd just be handing a competitor that's got four times the population an opportunity to, you know, support their economy and their people with, you know, low-cost, reliable energy at a time when we're eliminating low-cost, reliable energy here in the U.S. So from a geopolitical strategic standpoint, it also, our energy policies make no sense because they're weakening our relative position at a time where we're actually truly under threat from no longer being the sole global superpower and handing that advantage to a competitor. The other aspect of this is if we were investing in innovation in carbon-based industries like lignite-based electrical production, we could be in a position where we could actually be selling our decarbonization technologies to people like China, like India, and the rest of the world that are still operating coal plants and are still building coal plants, because when they're building these today, they're often building them with 1980s, 1990s technology. I don't think any of us in this room or anybody listening would think it would be a great deal if the federal government said, you can all use, you know, phones, but you can't use any phones that were built after 1995. By constraining and cutting off the capital to the carbon-based industries, one of the first things that goes is R&D. And when the R&D doesn't exist, then we stop investing in ways to decarbonize these baseloads. And so we're completely coming at it the wrong way, because for the size and scope of our energy industry, one of the places where we're really under-investing in R&D is all these things. Now, thankfully, North Dakota, through the, Lignite Energy Research Council, great new legislation from the legislators on clean, sustainable energy fund and others, we're starting to see R&D dollars coming in from the state, but often these are in the tens of millions. They need to go to the hundreds of millions, but as an industry, we should be investing billions in a trillion-dollar industry. So we continue to under-invest. Just yesterday, a large manufacturer reached out to Commerce and our office expressing concern about the cost and reliability of power on the East Coast. They're looking to, transfer their manufacturing plant to North Dakota. I think this is the first of many calls that we're going to get. But we also know that if they're calling North Dakota, why wouldn't they think about either keeping their manufacturing in China or keep it someplace where they could have access to low-cost, reliable baseload and resilient baseload? So, again, we will not only affect the price to consumers, we'll start driving jobs back overseas with a wrong-headed energy policy. As you know, here we're, as all of you, completely committed to a business-friendly environment. Stable, reliable energy is key to what we're doing, and that's why, again, Brent and I are always talking about innovation, not regulation. By the very nature, regulation is backward-looking. Even as efficient as all of you are, by the time something gets reviewed and you have the hearings and then you put it in place, if it might, entail legislation, which meets every 2 years, then you got to create administrative rules in some cases. As fast as our state move, it can be years. At the federal level, we know that some regulations, when they're really flying, can take 7 to 10 years to be put in place. And that might be a good scenario, coming from an industry where the fundamental driver of where I spent 35 years in the private sector was that everything was half the price and twice the power every 18 months. The idea that you're going to go through, a doubling of power, a doubling of power, a doubling of power, a doubling of power, okay, so 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, and then half, so you could be down to, 32 times the power at 1/16th the price. That's the reality of what's driving the digital world. That's the same amount of time it would take to get a federal regulation in place. And so some of these innovations that are going to solve the problems, whether it's in any form of energy, has underpinnings in digital technology. And so it's just impossible for federal regulation to keep up with the speed of innovation, and we're actually slowing it down. So I think you could look, we probably in our spare time look at interest at what's going on with the private sector going into space, and everybody's like, a bunch of folks that are, wealthy people going into space. Well, NASA, with all the federal dollars, has not been able to replace the space shuttle in, 20 some years. And then we got, SpaceX and others, private sector folks, at a fraction of the dollars, now doing safe manned flight. I mean, I think it's, again, an example of where innovation can occur. So, but, we are have great things going on here. The other, you know, the Clean Sustainable Energy Fund, $25 million in grants from the general fund, $250 million in loans from our state-owned bank in North Dakota. I would call that a good start. That's not the end-all, be-all. I think they're going to open up their grant rounds on November 1st. I think they're going to be overwhelmed in the first 6 months with grant requests that exceed that. I think the loan pool could easily disappear, and you know, in terms of things that we're looking for, because we have got so much interest from so many different companies that are coming here. In North Dakota, we do have a diverse portfolio, as you know, and we've got all these incredible natural resources that are here. Billions of barrels of oil, trillions of cubic feet of natural gas, 800 years worth of lignite. All that's interesting, because when I was coming out of high school, there was two things that were as certain as climate change is now. And in the late 70s, we were going to run out of energy and we're going to run out of food. And that was, you go back and look at the cover of Time magazine for 5 years, that's all I heard about when I was in college, was, world's going to get cold and dark and we're not going to have enough food, not enough energy. Well, innovation solved both of that. We've got, food aplenty, energy aplenty, and all kinds of innovation to try to, decarbonize that. This spring I did issue a goal to be carbon neutral by 2030, by the end of the decade. And we're very clear in the first 25 minutes of that speech that there would be no mandates, no regulation. This is all driven by innovation, and that no individual company in the state would have to change any practices they're doing for us to be able to meet that goal. And how is that possible? Well, the geologic jackpot that created the Bakken, which is, again, an amazing, we think of it as an amazing oil resource, but even as we sit here, the gas-oil ratio continues to just climb on a chart, and that's, again, there's just a new chart that just came out last week from Department of Minerals. Justin Kringstead with the Pipeline Authority is got a new report coming out. Because the ratio of gas to oil with the same amount of wells is going up, even though our oil production is now 400,000 barrels a day or more less than it was pre-pandemic, our gas production is equal to what it was pre-pandemic. Almost a third less oil, but the same amount of gas. How does that happen? It happens because the gas to oil ratio keeps increasing. So our takeaway capacity on gas is going to be constrained. We've got great gas in North Dakota. It's, rich or hot, however you want to describe it. But we need to drive, and part of the reason we're excited about all the potential investments in North Dakota is utilizing that gas in state through value-added approaches, and whether that's, petchem and plastics or advanced materials or hydrogen, which we'll talk about. Those are all ways where we can utilize that gas here. Otherwise, our oil production is going to be constrained because we don't have enough takeaway for the gas. And as we know from managing the state finances, the number one driver of our state finances is the 10% off the top that comes off the oil tax. So if you're just strictly trying to drive state policy based on revenue, which is important to feed, education and healthcare and roads and bridges, then we have to acknowledge that our state is in partnership with the oil and gas industry because they're driving so much revenue. But with that same geology that created this enormous resource on oil and gas, that's at the most of that today is at the 10,000 foot level. As people know, there's that 30 foot strip of shale called the Bakken, 10,000 feet down. And with the digital technology, we can go down 2 miles and over 2 miles, and now some of the laterals are down 2 miles and over 3 miles. And I had telling some folks from out of state that I was had a chance to, be in a drill shack, and they probably in their mind have some 1950s movie of, people covered with oil and, losing their fingers on a drill rig, and you're the 25-year-old petroleum engineer sitting in a room full of computers, screens. And I said, "Well, how accurate can you be when you're drilling?" And he said, "Sir, if your house was 2 miles down and 2 miles over, I could drill the lockout on the front door." And so where we've come in the last 10 years in terms of lowering the cost of the production and the precision that comes from the digital advances in that industry, people have even said that, there was an economist from the Federal Reserve from the Minneapolis district that said the only thing that could rival the microchip from 2010 to 2020 in terms of impact on the global economy was the technology that went into fracking in places like North Dakota, because that changed the geopolitical balance, it changed energy production. So we did, but in that, that's at 10,000 feet. At 7,000 feet below, the latest study from our great geological team here at the state of North Dakota, and working with the Energy and Environmental Research Center at the University of North Dakota, has concluded that we have the ability to store 252 billion tons of CO2 at the 7,000 foot level. Now you might say, well, how much is that? Well, that's about 4,400 years of the CO2 we produce in North Dakota, and it's about 50 years of the annual U.S. production. And if you could somehow magically get all the CO2 in the world to North Dakota right now, we could store all the world's CO2 for the next 5 years, just here in North Dakota. A little teeny patch of the planet where we've discovered where we've got, CO2 production. But if we take a look at just the region, the upper Midwest and the places where it would make sense to ship CO2 to North Dakota by pipeline for us to either use it for enhanced oil recovery or to use it for storage, or to use it innovatively in greenhouses, because putting pure streams of CO2 into greenhouses allows plants to grow substantially faster. And so again, part of the discussion that as we're continuing today, we'll talk about the connection between energy and ag and all the potential synergies that are occurring there. But Julie talked at the beginning about the regulatory environment. One of the great things that's occurred, starting with Governor Hovind, Governor Dalrymple, and in our administration, and the DMR and everybody else working, as we achieve primacy, the first state in the nation, where our state has the authority, not the federal government, on permitting a Class 6 injection well, which is the wells you need for CO2. We can tell investors from around the country that if you want to send your CO2 here, we will be able to permit it, and it's not going to get blocked by a federal election or a federal judge or all the politics that we know go around in the world you're living in with pipelines, where things get permitted and then they get reversed or reviewed for political reasons. We can really separate ourselves from that. Wyoming is the only other state that's followed us, so we do have a nearby state that is potentially a competitor for CO2 sequestration, because they also understand the importance of that primacy. But the legislature last year also passed clarity around who owns the pore space for CO2, and so we can know that we can legally compensate surface owners for that CO2 if they have a CO2 injection well on their surface, on the surface putting that down. So we can do it safely, we can do it permanently, and we can have landowners get paid, and we can permit it without federal government intervention. So that is the key. But we're not just focused on the storage or the sequestration, we're also focused on the utilization. And as I said, one of the great innovations that I predict is going to grow and grow and grow is greenhouses. There's a couple of projects that are being looked at right now. Globally, we're way behind. Iceland is in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, further north than we are. They're using geothermal and greenhouses, and they're a food exporter. The Netherlands, teeny little country that, most of it's below sea level, and through all of their engineering and the work that they've done, they're not just growing tulips in those greenhouses, they're also a food exporter. Mark Fox, this spring at the Williston Petroleum, chairman of MHA, the Manan Hadatsa Rikara Nation, they've already broken ground on a greenhouse that's going to cover the size of 7 football fields. And they can use, excess heat from flare gas to heat it, latest technology for insulation, and then drive CO2 into that, and it's going to be fantastic. And CO2, though, also happens to be a great solvent for freeing oil from shale, and we estimate that we could drive another 8 billion additional barrels, 8 billion barrels of oil by injecting CO2 in depleted oil fields. But to do that, we would have to import 10 times as much CO2 into our state as we actually produce now. And so we are not going to have enough CO2. So and CO2 is going to go from, carbon's going to go from the devil element on the periodic table that might be, taught in schools today, and it's going to be a value-added input that's going to allow us to have effectively decarbonized oil production. We know that the way that the companies achieve their ratings, where they're carbon neutral or carbon negative, is they utilize carbon. If you're a manufacturer that manufactures garments in Vietnam and you generate carbon there, you ship them on an oil tanker across the Pacific to the United States, you're generating carbon from that diesel that's there. You get into Long Beach, put them on a truck, you're generating the use of carbon fuels to drive them around. And then you do an offset, like plant trees in the Amazon, and then you market to all of your customers that you're carbon neutral. That's the way the system works. There is a oil company from Wyoming that is intending to move CO2 from Wyoming to North Dakota, put it into traditional 1980s vertical wells in southwestern North Dakota. They might have 5 injection wells for every well that's coming up. They will put more CO2. They'll put more than a ton of CO2 in the ground for every barrel of oil they bring up, and so we may have the first carbon negative oil company in the world in North Dakota. The great work that's being done by our CODEL on the work on the for equal treating related to reuse and sequestration under the 45Q tax credit, and we've also are working on incenting exemption or incremental oil produced from extraction taxes. That could be another way to utilize lots of CO2 in our state. So since we announced the goal in May, in a short period of months, if you ask anybody at the Bank of North Dakota, ask any Department of Commerce, anybody who's worked in North Dakota for decades, there has never been this kind of surge of potential large deals related to energy in North Dakota. And all of them are here because of the CO2 storage capability. And so we've now identified over $25 billion of potential projects coming to North Dakota. That number could be low. I spoke at the North Dakota Petroleum Conference last week, and someone came up to me afterwards and said, "Are we on that list?" And I go, "Yes." He goes, "What do you have us down for?" And I said, told him the number, and he goes, "Well, our number could be twice that. So we might have to add another. It might be 26 billion, but I'm sticking with 25 for now." But there's all these projects. We won't land all of them because we're competing with other states, but these are carbon capture, value added, carbon negative that they're looking for. And carbon negative plastics, you use CO2 and methane as inputs. They're naturally biodegradable. And we could solve both the carbon and the single use plastics question, right here in North Dakota. EERC is working on a really exciting thing they presented to the NDIC last week, and might be interesting to have EERC come and give you a report on all the things they're doing related to carbon and CO2, but one of them is a thing called graphene, which is like single, element cells, if you will, that are the size, a strand of graphene elements would be the size of a human hair. It would be strong enough to hold a piano. Okay, that seems impossible, but we've all for 20 years said, "Oh, carbon fiber, it's the lightest, strongest material." That's why aircraft and Formula One cars and police vests and everybody are switching to carbon fiber, because it's so effective. Well, we have an opportunity in North Dakota. If everybody's shipping us our CO2 and we're putting it in the ground, if in 10 or 20 years from now these industries develop, we can pull it back out again. We'll not only get paid to take other people's CO2, we'll have an opportunity to then mine that resource in the future. And so anyway, those are big opportunities. Hydrogen, which Randy asked about, Mitsubishi announced earlier this year that they're involved here partnering with a company, Bakken Energy, and their intention is to acquire the Dakota Coal Gasification Plant, which, as you know, was built in the 1980s. With billions of dollars of federal money, because we thought it was, German World War II technology of turning coal to gas because the U.S. was going to run out of natural gas. Well, now we're awash with natural gas, so it's tough economically to turn coal into natural gas when, right now we're flaring more gas in North Dakota than Dakota Coal Gasification produces. And so just look at those economics where we're burning off more than we're producing. But to have someone come in and say, we can take that giant chemistry set on the plains, the 550 jobs, preserve all those jobs, and convert that into a hydrogen hub is kind of a miracle, because without that, the future there would be very, very challenging. It's easier to see a path for the lignite coal industry, decarbonizing that than it is trying to decarbonize where you're taking lignite coal and turning it to gas and then trying to sell gas into a market where we've got excess gas. Although the price of gas is a little higher right now, which is a good thing. Some of that is, again, not because of supply. That's because of, you know, political disruptions that are occurring related to Gazprom and Russia and pipelines in Europe. And so gas prices are up in Asia and Europe, and they're coming up a little bit here, which is a good thing because that helps us capture flaring. But again, other things that we need for across all these industries, the legislation that's passed around salt cavern storage is going to be incredible. I had an opportunity with the legislative leaders to go up to Alberta 2 years ago and see the operation up there. People think, oh, you can't build this petchem stuff this far north. I mean, we'll then go 600 miles further north, northeast of Edmonton, and look at a place where you've got cows grazing in fields in between a Shell petchem plant, a Dow petchem plant, and, you know, dozens of others. 40,000 jobs have been created in entire cities, beautiful new schools and beautiful new fire stations, and in between them, like cows grazing on pastures. I mean, this is a, you know, clean, fantastic industry, and again, this could provide all kinds of solutions that would help the overall country. The other thing, which again, as we take a look at utilization as part of this, hydrogen could also be an opportunity for the ag industry because ammonia can be one of the byproducts on how you do this. And we know that in our state right now, we only produce about a third of the ammonia we need for fertilizing our crops. And as corn in particular comes more acres and moves north and west, we have more demands for fertilizer. When we have a fall like we had in October of 19, when we had the disastrous 3 feet of snow and blizzard, and then our state didn't have enough drying capacity for all those crops, and we had billions of dollars of crops harvested, and we're relying on propane for that. We only produce about less than a third of the propane we need in our state. So again, we're, you know, shipping our natural gas now into Kansas, turning it into fertilizer and propane, and trucking it back to North Dakota. So there are big opportunities there on this for ag and other synergies. And as we've also seen, when we've got, as you know, when we got co-located ethanol plants with power plants, that's exciting. Some of the projects we're looking at are looking at that co-location. Greenhouses are looking at co-location in places where they can get access to steam heat coming off of a coal plant and CO2 off an ethanol plant. We've got multiple locations where those two things exist where we could get them a clean stream of CO2 and great heat. And so that's a win-win. And then we also, as we saw with what's happening with ADM and Marathon, where we got a big, you know, soybean plant being built in Jamestown, that market has shifted from a meal market to an oil market. That makes it economic. Cass County has now emerged as the number one soybean acre county in the country, not in Indiana, not in Illinois, not in Iowa. Cass County, number one soybean acres. That plant, that $350 million plant, is only going to take about 25% of the crop in North Dakota. We could add two or three more soy crush plants here. But if oil's driving the market, they produce the oil, they ship it by rail, we save a refinery in Dickinson that would have been shut down, they're going to turn it into green diesel and sell it into California for a premium. So, you know, in conclusion, I just want to say again, gratitude for being here, and I want to say a thank you for the amazing work that you're doing. I know you're committed to creating a stable, predictable regulatory environment that promotes innovation. You just do a fantastic job across the dozens of areas that you have to focus on. So thanks to you and your staff. And again, I think that, you know, together, if we let innovation drive the way, the future of energy industry across all segments of energy is really bright in North Dakota. But I also think that together, what we have going on in North Dakota is an energy policy that is better here in North Dakota than we have for our nation. And I'm hoping that we can get to a point where North Dakota's energy policy actually drives and helps us geopolitically, it helps us economically, and it helps the environment, because that's what our policy is doing. So thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Governor. Very interesting and inspiring vision. So I did a little bit of research and noted that, based on my searching, there's only 8 states that have established a net zero goal, and most of them, 5 of them, set it for 2050, and 2 of them for 2045. So we are out there on the front edge leading this and very, you know, aggressively kind of paving the way, so that's exciting. I'm interested in your what you're hearing back from utilities, our utilities, because obviously that's the area where we're most involved. And, well, we as a commission have always taken a very firm stance that our job as regulators is twofold, affordability and reliability. That's not necessarily where every other commission in the state, in the country is. There's a lot of commissions that are getting pulled or pushed or walking into, you know, more of the environmental goals and leadership in those areas. But I think, you know, for myself, I have grave concerns over this winter's reliability and this winter's cost, just based on the retirements that we're seeing and what we saw last February with gas and gas markets. I hope we don't have the same cold spell, but, you know, we just aren't prepared with the infrastructure to run our system on gas like people are expecting us to, and like other state regulatory agencies are expecting, or even like the RTOs, I think, are hoping can be done. So I'm curious what you're hearing from our utilities. We haven't had conversations with them a lot, at least publicly, about this net zero and how they see themselves fitting into it. But obviously, the coal-fired facilities in North Dakota are some of our biggest emissions, some of our greatest opportunities for enhanced oil recovery if we can capture it. What are you hearing from them? And how can we speed things up on the carbon capture technology?
Well, number of questions there, but I would just say, again, part of the, I share your concern about this winter, I share your concern about instability, and I applaud the commission's approach to reliability and affordability, because that's what we need. I think those two things, to have affordability and have reliability, implies that we're going to keep innovating, and with the innovation, we're going to take care of the CO2 issue. This idea that right now where regulators in other states put policies in place which sometimes force utilities to try to meet an emissions goal, then each one of them tries to optimize, and by each one of them optimizing for their own emissions goals, they're actually destabilizing the grid by shutting down their baseload. And so it's very predictable. What's being asked of them is, you know, hit this goal. Well, how am I going to hit that goal? Well, I'll get rid of my baseload. I hope somebody else keeps their baseload on, because we're not, because we're going to go to, you know, all, you know, non-dispatchable, and so that creates a, you know, I mean, we're just set up for a problem, and that's why we're experiencing some of the problems we are, is because everybody is optimizing for their own, and then it creates sub-optimism for the entire grid. So I think we just have to push back against that and have to try to help, you know, save and preserve and extend base load. And one of the things we're doing, one of the big things, is Project Tundra. And I know that is one of the things that is going to be large scale. I'm confident with the ultimate sale of Coal Creek, that part of the Coal Creek business model going forward is going to be carbon sequestration, or it's going to be carbon capture and utilization and making money selling that CO2 to other people. And that's, you know, probably something a privately owned North Dakota company can do that a Minnesota-owned, shareholder-owned, or co-op-owned can't do because of they're underneath a set of rules, you know, from the neighboring state, which wouldn't allow them to say, hey, we can actually figure out a way to solve a CO2 problem and get paid to do it. And so those are, so I think, again, sometimes corporate structure is going to matter, and that's why, again, the Coal Creek thing is really important. I did, last night, we did have, I guess, about 14 Minnesota legislators here, and I shared last night at that group that they asked what's the biggest thing we could do, and I said, well, then you should, you know, share your voices in Minnesota to make sure that the permit gets transferred on the direct current line, so that we can proceed with proceed with decarbonizing baseload. You'll still get the baseload you want, but we can send you decarbonized stuff sooner. You know, why hold this thing up when this is part of the path of the future that they want? So I think it solves both of their goals. But that's I think that the utility companies that understand the need for, you know, for baseload are looking hard at carbon capture, utilization, and storage. And you might have others that are saying, we're going to hope somebody else provides the baseload. That's why we have this, you know, the danger of having an unstable grid.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard much pushback or feedback from our, like, the utilities in North Dakota since you announced this goal?
Well, I think it's
like
good to be.
Like concerns, like oof,
I always
want to
be honest
there.
And transparent. I mean, when you announce a 2030, you know, net carbon neutral at the largest at the time, it was the largest in-person gathering of the oil industry had in 18 months. You know, there was maybe some folks in the back that weren't listening closely, and that's all they heard. They didn't hear the first 25 minutes on innovation and no mandates and no regulation. But what we have heard and what we're seeing in this list of the tens of billions of dollars of deals is people are saying you've flipped the story on ESG, and now companies from not only the U.S. but overseas are saying, wow, North Dakota has this incredible storage capability. They're open for business, and they have a regulatory environment that would allow us to come and do projects, because this $45 trillion can't just get locked up and not spent on energy. So these are energy companies, mm-hmm. and if they've been narrowed on where I can invest and they're looking for returns, they see that there is actual return on investment for the decades it takes to capture that return in investing in decarbonizing fossil fuels, as opposed to, oh, we're going to, you know, somehow magically, you know, go to all renewables tomorrow, because battery technology is not moving at the speed of digital innovation. Battery technology gets better at about 2% a year, and it has forever. It's not tracking on digital is exponential and goes up. Battery is like this. And so until you have a solution where you can store vast amounts of, you know, renewable intermittent energy, and that's 10, 20, 30 years away, we need a transition period. And the transition is going to be lower cost and more effective to focus around things related to decarbonizing and who's in the best spot. And again, the companies that produce electricity in North Dakota, in many cases, are sitting right on top of the storage capability. I know that they, you know, with Tundra, they were drilling two test wells and thinking that they're going to need two Class 6 wells to store all the CO2 coming off that project. And the early tests indicate that they'll be able to store all of it with one. So then the other one would be available to take somebody else's CO2. So, I mean, we're looking very promising on that front.
You guys,
I do.
Jump in.
Message, Governor, just messaging is always a critical component, and there's a stigma about coal-fired electrons that exists somewhat within our borders at times, but it becomes a challenge as you move beyond the state's borders. As a part of your vision and plan, what type of messaging do you envision to the public, again, particularly those who reside outside of our state's borders, but both to the public and the financial community, that a clean electron is a clean electron. But again, there's that stigma that is out there, and there will be some headwinds by those who will be opposed to the continued use of coal. It's a critical element, part of our economy, but people may not realize it when they live in Minneapolis or they live in other parts of the country. It's important to them too in terms of reliability and affordability when you look at long-term cost projections. So from a messaging standpoint, I know it's a very broad question, but how will that be incorporated into your vision?
Well, it's super relevant, Brian, because again, move public opinion, public support, and I think you're seeing that messaging reflecting in our dialogue today, which is it's not about coal has been branded as sort of the problem, but if you really say what's the real issue that people are concerned, they're concerned about CO2 emissions. And if you're concerned about CO2 emissions, then say we're addressing CO2 emissions, and if we've taken those to zero, if we're net neutral, then if we've decarbonized, if you will, energy sources, whether that's oil, natural gas, or coal, if we've decarbonized them, then they should all be on the same playing field. And if it's cheaper, faster, more effective, and better for the environment to decarbonize than to like transform our entire industry into other things ahead of when we've got the storage capacity, ahead of when we've got,
transmission.
I mean, this idea that somehow we're going to eliminate the internal combustion, engine, from our lives and have all EV. I hear that in the $3.5 trillion plan, there's, 500,000 EV charging stations. I don't see, it takes 10 years if you're lucky to permit a transmission line. How would you get transmission lines into the northeastern part of the U.S. where the most density of cars are? You know, I mean, there's not, it's hard to get them done in the open spaces out here. So I think that there's some big missing pieces there. And then the infrastructure that's taken a century to build. I mean, you're sort of going to take a century of gas stations and replace them with something else. I mean, it, you know, these things take time. I'm not saying don't do electrical vehicles or don't build charging stations. I'm just saying it's impossible to think that somehow in a short period of time you're going to flip the hundreds and millions of vehicles that Americans have, particularly at affordability. I mean, who's, you know, there's a price factor here. So we have an opportunity to get to the same solution of less CO2 faster by decarbonizing. And North Dakota can be a big part of that. So that's where I think the key message there is this the role that we can play in reducing CO2. If narrow the problem to what people say it is, it's CO2, then we'll reduce it.
Yeah, that's good to hear, because the reality is for states that want to go to 100% renewable energy and they tout these goals, they need really good neighbors in order to do that, because those resources aren't always there. That's good to hear.
And at state level, regulations often pass regulations like they're an island, but when they're actually part of an interconnected network with high dependencies on, in the case here, of the baseload that's being produced in North Dakota. I mean, I think last year during the polar vortex, weren't we at 90% of the electrons heading into the grid were coming off of coal? I mean, it's a... Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. Again, when you think about, you know, education, when you think about healthcare, I mean, when you think about, I've talked to the governor of Texas. I mean, when you have, it was great for plumbers, you know, the polar vortex, they had frozen pipes through the whole state. But I mean, you know, if we didn't have power in North Dakota for 2 days, I mean, we'd have issues on everything from livestock to healthcare to hospitals to whatever. I mean, it's just an impossibility for us to think about. Mm-hmm. Randy?
So. First of all, let me say I am impressed with and relieved by your thoroughness and grasp of some of these energy-related issues. So I applaud you and thank you for that. I do sometimes gristle at the line of innovation, not regulation, because although I'm a low-regulation guy, I got to tell you, things like reclamation and monopoly utilities, some regulation is needed in this world, too. And so I think it should be innovation and responsible regulation or something like that. But anyway, how this ends up impacting here, one of the things that I have concern about with the hydrogen that I mentioned earlier, I've never heard exactly what Mitsubishi wants to do with the hydrogen, but whether it's piping it out to large users somewhere, or I also read and hear about thoughts of mixing in a certain percent into our distribution, our natural gas distribution system for just regular everyday use. In either event, we may need to relook at our siting requirements for pipelines. I mean, it's pretty volatile stuff. I don't know if we want the same standards for hydrogen pipelines as we have for oil and gas. But then secondly, and this is the one I worry about the most, if it's going to be mixed in with our regular natural gas usage, we've worked with our natural gas producers. There's some who, they don't even, over the years, know which types of natural gas pipe are in which areas of which communities. And there's a lot of these. I'm not sure whether they're going to withstand hydrogen. And so there could end up being big impacts to the ratepayers buying cheap energy, but then having to replace a bunch of natural gas lines. So part of me is excited about this happening. Part of me is glad that there's a few years. There's a lot of work to do on that to figure out how to exactly build out for hydrogen. I'd just like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think those are all the right questions that should be asked and will continue to be asked. The good news is we have time to ask them, because even on their timetable, I think if you were going to try to build a hydrogen hub from scratch, you could be talking 5-6 years or more. It's believed that because of the opportunity to refit much of what has been called the chemistry set on the plains, you know, the Dakota coal gasification, that they're really coming into a site where they can reutilize a lot of the existing equipment and technology that's there. And so then maybe they could get it done in, you know, 2 to 3 years. So we've got a window of time to understand how that is going to be put together. I think when they were talking about it initially at the, you know, initial press conference, they were talking about having a network of interstate pipelines that would move, you'd be able to move hydrogen around. I mean, if you take, you know, the long-term look out 20, 30 years, just like we've got the pipeline network, which you're familiar with interstate pipelines, I'm thinking they're talking about dedicated hydrogen pipelines for interstate movement. There's also, again, in terms of, you know, potential target areas that I've heard people talk about is these large-scale, high-powered fuel cells. And so because we know that in a cold environment, you're not going to be moving, you know, a semi-truck with, you know, an 80-foot trailer and another trailer behind that, you know, a 60-footer behind that. I mean, what we see people moving goods across here, because the cold weather and batteries just don't work, but hydrogen cells do. And so whether it's, you know, Burlington Northern diesel engines, you know, flipping over to hydrogen, or large scale trucks for northern climates, I think those are two markets that might never be electric, but could be hydrogen. So I think those are some of the markets that they're also looking at, what I'd call, you know, sort of a niche piece in transportation fuels where hydrogen cells could displace diesel.
Okay. I think we're going to have to really watch our distribution network though on that and figure out what it's capable of.
Yep, absolutely. And I think the other thing that is discussed, you know, well, there, prior to building it all out, there are some technologies where you could create ammonia and then use our ammonia transportation system to move the ammonia and then convert the ammonia back to hydrogen closer to the site. If it was a manufacturing site or a facility that was using that source of power. And so there probably is going to be a sort of, I call it a hybrid, where that could be. And that could be the same even if they were trying to, you know, say, ship, you know, energy to Japan. I mean, we had this largest trade mission ever in North Dakota, perhaps ever from any country, but it was every major Japanese company. I mean, you know, Toyota and Honda and all the big, you know, trading companies and Mitsubishi. I mean, they were, and they were senior people that were here, and we had like, you know, 25 of them here last month. We spent 2 days in North Dakota, and every single one of them, they want to buy our ag products, but they're super interested in hydrogen. This is a country that's got 128 million people in the size of North and South Dakota with 4,000 barrels of oil a day of production. Okay, they've got less than like a single rancher in North Dakota has in oil production. All of their oil production is coming from the Middle East through the South China Sea. China's now got 50 more naval ships than the United States does. They're building out these islands in the South China Sea as permanent aircraft carriers that you can't sink. And so if you're Japan and you've got no military and you've got someone who could cut off your energy overnight, they are eager, isn't the word, to try to build a relationship with someone who's got excess food and energy. They've identified North Dakota as that partner, and we could have a long-term great relationship with Japan, you know, which it seems, again, there's a little bit oddness to me. My dad, you know, was a naval officer, fought in World War II against him for 2.5 years. Thankfully, he came home. Some of his, you know, shipmates didn't, but, you know, here we are in 2021, and they could be a tremendous ally in our geopolitical fight right now, and they need what we have, and they are, all of those companies are here, we're asking about hydrogen, and how do we get it there? So could we ship, you know, the way we ship ammonia today, I mean, ship them ammonia, they convert it to hydrogen when it gets back over there, but those are all things that it could be transition until we get an international, you know, hydrogen for export is another possibility, and that's, I'm sure, what Mitsubishi and others are looking at.
Interesting. Just to turn it a bit more towards not as an exciting or fun topic, but it's something that I'm somewhat obsessed with, which is grid reliability. So you talk about the ESG and the pressures that you've seen, you know, North Dakota companies under, and now with the change in the net zero goal, how much more interest there is in North Dakota. So the utilities are under those same ESG pressures. And if you look at the amount of retirements scheduled just in the MISO region by 2030, it'll make your jaw drop.
And then you look at the replacement and you're going, well, how is this possible? It's mostly solar.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, it's ESG that's driving so much of this for the utilities. They just can't get support for their units and their end of life and all these sorts of things. What are governors? I know the last 2 years you guys have been pretty much 100% focused, I'm sure, on COVID and et cetera, when you all get together. But does this come up? Do governors appreciate what's going on from a broad standpoint in, like, your colleagues in other states who aren't knee-deep in energy like you are? Are they seeing what's happening? Are they expressing concerns or suggesting, like you are, we can get there, but we can get there faster this way, or we can take a little extra time and not threaten affordability and reliability? Just curious where the governors in general are throughout the region and through your networks of governors on this issue.
I don't want to generalize, but as past chair of Western Governors Association, which my term ended during the middle of COVID, that spans, you know, from Alaska, Hawaii, the Pacific Islands, the West Coast, and then through into energy producing states like Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, Oklahoma. And so it's a real split. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got some governors that are running on, campaigning on, and charging ahead and fully, you know, fully in and fully supported by those that want to go to all renewables and haven't really thought through the implications. Then you've got governors from energy states that are very concerned about it. So it's a big split. I think between NGA and RGA, RGA is more focused on the energy issues, mm-hmm. maybe because you've got more Republicans from energy states, but I think that there's definitely within RGA an understanding that the national energy policy is leading towards increased stability. And I think the Texas situation last year was a wake-up call for all governors, because I think a lot of governors mm-hmm. don't think about the grid.
Right.
Just like every other citizen, they're working a bunch of things. And then you wake up and, wow, that happened to Texas? They're a big energy state. How did that all happen there? So I think, but then there was a lot of press that was confusing, and even some misinformation coming out, like all things today, after the fact of that didn't really clarify where some of the underlying problems were. So I think it's a big mix. Mm-hmm. But I see it as an opportunity for North Dakota to lead, because I think we've got a policy that is going to be great for the environment, great for consumers, great for employers, great for our country, and great for our geopolitical strategic role in the world. I mean, all of those hits on all those things, so we keep driving it forward.
To the extent that you are working through those networks in this area, I know that leadership at the RTOs, both MISO and SPP, definitely take notice when they get letters from governors. So other governors' groups are, I know, have sent letters to MISO asking for a more push for transmission to support the renewable development. I've thought, you know, another approach as important as that would be governors supporting sustainability, reliability, affordability, and making sure that MISO is keeping a close watch on the speed of retirements and whether that's sustainable. So,
well, anyway. I think it's a great suggestion. Reason I'll take that as an action item. I think getting a group of governors to, particularly ones that are exporting electricity, that are on the receiving end of some of the regulations, but are. Yeah. That would be a good group. That would be easy to get some of those folks signed up. But I think, and again, for the grid operators, they should have all the data. I mean, I would encourage them to have the courage to stand up against some of these things and say, look, if part of their role is grid stability and grid reliability and grid resilience, they should be the ones that are saying, not everybody can do these retirements at the same time.
Yeah.
And they've got to be testifying at state legislature to say the state legislature is, hey, your thing may work to help get somebody reelected, but it's also going to put your citizens in the dark and in the cold when you really need it. Because again, you can't, each company in each state can't optimize for a set of ideological principles at the expense of us having a, I mean, this is the United States, it's 2021. I mean, we should have a we should have the most reliable, lowest cost electricity in the world. That should be the goal.
If I could just add to that point, though, one thing, you know, we think oftentimes that all the energy exporting states would just have the same ideas as opposed to states that don't. But one of the things in that, beyond the reliability, then goes back to the affordability. And there are energy exporting states that seem to be on the same kick with, frankly, some of the utility companies that are members of these RTOs. That yes, we can get there with all renewables. We just need to build more transmission. But then again, at the end of the day, which is probably good for exporting states. But then it falls back on those pesky regulators again, because at the very end of the day, it's going to be the ratepayers that have to pay for that transmission, and we're going to have to add those costs onto the utility bills. So yeah, it can potentially be achieved with enough transmission, but it's going to be very, very expensive.
Well, higher electrical bills and higher prices of gas at the pump and higher natural gas prices for consumers is a enormous tax on working families of America. The people that often in large metro areas that have to commute the farthest are the ones that pay the biggest toll, the ones that have blue-collar jobs that can't remote in from their laptop. And so, again, these energy policies that drive the price of electricity, the price of gas, the price of gasoline, and the price of natural gas up are a huge tax on again, the people that need the least. And there's people aren't connecting that dot between a particular policy's energy party policies and sometimes the people that vote for them. But they're like, it's this is the net result. I mean, and this is, again, where I'd like, you know, in addition to innovation over all regulation except North Dakota PSC regulation. we should also be saying that it should be economics over ideology, because the economics is what's going to help, you know, help drive those, you know, drive the positive changes for our environment as well.
Mm-hmm. Again, thanks for this opportunity. It's very helpful. I feel rude to be doing this, but we have some very worthy Reclamation Award recipients that I don't want to hold up either. So.
Well, I'll see you down there at noon. So, again, thank you, guys.
I think maybe one of the takeaways would be to place a moratorium on state legislatures deciding resource, generating resource types, and let the scientists and the analysts actually do that for us instead. But I believe Steve has a question.
Yeah, Steve, turn your mic.
Sorry. Governor, I just had one question in listening to all of the discussion. Is North Dakota primarily or maybe at least initially going to have to look at utilizing a lot of this internally? Because it seems like no matter what kind of a transmission line and or pipeline interstate that you're trying to build is virtually impossible in this environment. And even though it's going to be carbon neutral, I'm wondering if we're actually going to be able to build that infrastructure.
Well, I think, you know, one example that's underway is the Summit Solutions from Iowa, and you're probably familiar with that. But, you know, they've got a project, a $3.1 billion pipeline that is going to gather CO2 from 25 biorefineries, so ethanol plants and biodiesel plants across Iowa, Minnesota, South Dakota, eastern North Dakota. And then bring those, you know, tier two North Dakota. And my understanding is that they're making great progress on getting the easements and getting the permitting and moving that thing forward. So, you know, maybe we won't have the same set of people protesting pipelines if it's trying to move CO2 to store it that we do when it's trying to move fossil fuels. We'll see if they can discriminate between the two or understand the difference between the two, but at least sounds like they're have it off to a good start. And I don't know if you've had discussions with them or not, but that gives me hope. And I'm very obviously very based on my prior comments, I hope that can get built so that the end of that line is in North Dakota and it can benefit all four ethanol plants in our state and help the ethanol industry. If we can't figure out how to get it done, the economics are there, and they'll build it to Wyoming, and Wyoming will be happy to receive their CO2. And so I would like to see us have it, because I think, again, if it's a got the potential to use either for storage now, products later, or enhanced oil recovery, or shove it into a greenhouse. I mean, all those things. I mean, like I said, we are not going to have enough CO2 in North Dakota, so we would like to have it become in this way.
I hope you're right, and I hope they can discriminate between
them. And as I'll quote Senator Hovind, when he heard about it, he goes, well, he said, if they're building a $3.1 billion pipeline, I don't think they're planning on moving $10 million of CO2. So there must be, they must see that there's, you know, value in that equation for them to build that kind of infrastructure here that we could then, you know, tie into across North Dakota.
One of the opportunities, an obvious opportunity that a lot of North Dakotans point out to all of us on a regular basis, I'm sure you get the same thing, is when we're flaring all that gas, it's such a waste, and why can't we use that to produce, you know, electricity, et cetera, et cetera. And there are some very viable solutions out there that could take that, generate on-site, and sell it back to the grid. I think you guys are meeting Reese with the Mesa Solutions. That's one of the companies. I'm not endorsing them. I just have looked at their technology, and I know that it works in a lot of places where others have struggled just in terms of the cold weather, et cetera. And that would be an amazing win to help and to turn that conversation from, like, we aren't wasting this product. We're using it in the middle of our cold snaps to keep the power and keep the lights on, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that I haven't heard our utilities express interest in that, but I know Basin is working with Mesa on sort of like a 10-megawatt project where they can generate power at wherever wells, they sell it back to Basin, and they can generate up to 10 megawatts, which is a decent, you know, amount to help level out a peak or whatever that Basin might experience. I think most of that will be with the co-ops because they are outside of the investor-owned regions or territories. But another super exciting opportunity for turning a negative into a positive and a win for and solving two problems. We need more electricity. We need less flaring. No more emissions. I mean, it's just a win-win-win all the way around. And for the producers, et cetera. So keep your eye out for that, and to the extent that you can promote it with the producers, I think that's the link where it's the toughest, because it's just a new way of thinking that they have to entertain and feel like it's viable. Brian, do you have any other additional thoughts or questions?
I have a lot of thoughts and probably 100 questions I can ask, but don't want to wear out our welcome either. And if you are targeting noon, I know you're starting to approach a hard stop. So thank you for the time.
Appreciate that. I would say on the point solutions on flare gas and electricity, great point. And I think there are a number of innovative things that are coming. Some of those want to put electricity in the grid. We've also got multiple different folks that are looking at using gas to electricity on a well pad, but then use it for cryptocurrency mining.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Those are also good cold weather environments, because the amount of computing power they have in those portable containers generates enough heat that they actually just need to let the cold air in. And so that's another source opportunity there. And so that's fun to see those coming. I think one of the things when we're talking about regulation and the good job that yourself and DMR and others are doing, I was reminded when I was visually, when I was coming back from NDPC the other night, that the federal regulation challenges of getting gas gathering lines built within MHA with easement problems, you know, creates a disparity where when we list our state flaring issue, a lot of that flaring is occurring because of the slow speed of federal permitting for gas gathering lines. So again, a government that is professing to, you know, want to, you know, do executive orders to shut down, you know, shut down development of a resource that belongs to all American people, not to the federal government. And in the case, you know, in the tribal case, then at the same time, not allowing the permitting that would allow the tribe to gather that gas. So they're right now, they're losing money on all that stuff that's not being gathered also. So
yeah.
So that's a, it's an unfortunate situation. The checkerboard of federal land creates a, is part of that. The 9 or 10% of gas that's still being flared, there's a measurable part of that that's being impacted by federal regulations.
Yeah, I believe it. I believe it. And then, yet they come and wag their finger at us and scorn us for flaring. Oh, man. Anybody else have any questions? Excellent. Well, very good. Was fun to visit this morning. Maybe we can make this an annual event. We can change locations, we can come down, you can come up, we can, you know, endless possibilities. Go to the 18th floor maybe, just for the view.
Home and away, we're super grateful for the invitation, really fun to be with you, and like I said again, we're just full of gratitude for everything the PSC does, and thanks for your leadership, and Brian and Randy, everything that you guys do, because you guys are, like I said, super citizen focused, and putting in a lot of smart regulation to help North Dakota and the country do its very best, so thank you.
Thank you, and consider, I think all of us are on board with helping any way we can towards this aspirational goal, and you can count on me for one. I'll be talking about it ad nauseum. People are going to be sick of me talking about it whenever I can, because I think it's just the right direction. So thank you for taking the leadership.
Well, thank you, and I think, as you know, it ties really into the thing that we've been fighting as a state. I mean, we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the state mill and the state elevator. Those both were created because we were felt as a state we were captive to interests outside of the state, you know, Minneapolis millers, Minneapolis bankers, and we needed to have more control and add value to our products here and control that. And this is really, we're still fighting that battle 100 years later, where now, you know, we see when we have takeaway constraints or the threats against something legally permitted infrastructure like DAPL, or these issues with, you know, transmissions and other states putting, you know, source limitations on the electrons, we're still battling that. And one solution is for us just to add way more value to the resource here. And that's why we're really excited about the $25 billion of identified capital that is coming related to the CO2 storage, because all of that would mean adding value to our ag and our energy here in the state, which gives us, you know, more control over our destiny. And I think that everybody here knows that nobody cares more about the environment than the North Dakotans that live here, when 90% of the state is farms and ranchers, privately owned, 90%. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're a state that we're a fraction of the federal ownership of other states. I mean, Utah, Wyoming, some of these other ones are over 50% federal. I mean, we're fortunate that we've got a small percentage, but because of the checkerboard nature, those, you know, you can have a ban on federal drilling and it affects a third of our spacing units. So it's a big, big issue for us. But the good news is that we got landowners that care about their land, they care about the water, they care about their creeks, their stock ponds. And we're going to be able to show the world we can do both, that we can be a incredibly successful and responsible energy producer, and we can do that in a way that protects the environment that we all live and care for.
Excellent. Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Till we meet.